From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what is corrupt, comical, cynical, and noble about the political process? Newsweek's congressional correspondent Stephen Waldman traced one bill, Clinton's National Service Plan, from its conception to its passage. Waldman will tell us what it shows about how Congress works. And we'll talk about the culture of Congress from the point of view of a former congressman. Democrat Timothy Penny spent 12 years in the House, representing a rural part of Minnesota. In his new memoir, he writes about why he became disillusioned with Congress. Also today, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new releases by saxophonist James Carter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former Pennsylvania Governor Robert Casey has decided not to challenge President Clinton in the 1996 Democratic primaries. Casey says he is not up to the rigors of a presidential campaign. Casey is a fervent foe of abortion and a frequent critic of Mr. Clinton. He'd set up a presidential exploratory committee to begin fundraising, but Casey, who has undergone a rare heart-liver transplant, says fundraising and other travel had raised doubts about whether he could keep up the energy level needed for a national campaign. French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé is again calling for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. France wants to debate a resolution extending the Bosnia ceasefire and bettering protection for peacekeepers. Two French peacekeepers were killed by Bosnian snipers over the weekend. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The French initiative comes against the backdrop of the French presidential election, in which some politicians have raised the possibility French peacekeepers may have to be pulled out. But privately, French diplomats caution against any suggestion that France has made up its mind to leave Bosnia. Rather, the recent statements and threats are a sign that politicians are concerned French public opinion could become inflamed as a result of continued losses. So far, 33 French peacekeepers have died and over 250 have been wounded since France entered Yugoslavia in 1992. And as the situation in Bosnia continues to deteriorate, there is mounting concern that, as Juppé told reporters, the peacekeepers are turning into hostages. Also, Juppé said there was strong reason to believe one of the French peacekeepers was killed by Bosnian government troops. However, he offered no proof. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
A new poll finds support for congressional proposals to shift power from the federal government to states is overwhelming, but plans to cut government regulations entirely draw only limited support. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
20 years ago, polls showed that roughly half of all Americans thought Congress, the White House, and the Supreme Court were doing a very good job running the country. But a new poll released by the Bipartisan Council for Excellence in Government says only 15% of the public feels that same high level of confidence today. The new national survey also showed that two-thirds of the public favors proposals to concentrate power in state governments and not at the federal level. State programs were thought to be fairer, better managed, and less costly. Nearly three-quarters of Americans also think regulations raise prices and interfere with the free market system, but an equal number say government regulations have left the workplace safer and the environment cleaner. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
Three-time Super Bowl Most Valuable Player Joe Montana has announced his retirement from the National Football League. He says he's had 16 wonderful years, most of them in San Francisco. He has spent the last 2 years with the Kansas City Chiefs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 16 points at 4,179. This is NPR. The winners of this year's Pulitzer Prizes have been announced. A tiny newspaper in the U.S. Virgin Islands has won the top award for public service. The Virgin Islands Daily News in St. Thomas beat out much larger papers with its series on how the crime rate in the area was linked to corruption in the criminal justice system. The Pulitzer for Fiction has gone to Carol Shields for The Stone Diaries. The winner of the Biography Award is Joan Hedrick for Harriet Beecher Stowe, A Life. The Pulitzer Prize for Drama has been awarded to Horton Foote for The Young Man from Atlanta. A report in the Journal of the American Medical Association shows new evidence that regular exercise can lengthen life. But the study also suggests now not all exercises do this. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Researchers at Harvard University studied more than 17,000 Harvard graduates, all of them men. The scientists found that those who engaged in vigorous exercise, such as jogging, swimming, or playing tennis about 3 hours a week, were as much as 25% less likely to die during the course of the study than their sedentary classmates. This is little surprise, given that exercise is known to ward off heart disease and other illnesses. But the researchers found no evidence that regular light exercise, such as walking at a moderate pace or playing golf, could extend one's lifespan at all. This suggests federal health guidelines recommending a half hour of moderate physical activity daily may be inadequate to provide significant health benefits. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
Investigators in Alabama are working to recover remains of the victims of an Air Force jet crash. The Air Force says the team has pulled the flight data recorder from the wreckage. The plane crashed last night near Alexander City, Alabama, killing all 8 people aboard, including the Air Force's Assistant Secretary, Clark Feaster. No cause for the accident has yet been determined. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Voters' eyes are on Washington these days as a new Republican-controlled Congress tries to reinvent business as usual in the Capitol. Newsweek's congressional correspondent Stephen Waldman has done a case study of business as usual. He followed one bill from its beginnings as a campaign promise through its passage in Congress. He says he chose President Clinton's National Service Bill because it was a program Clinton hoped would reestablish faith in government. It also tested how Clinton rationalized the 2 strains of his political personality, his idealism and pragmatism. Waldman's new book is titled The Bill, How the Adventures of Clinton's National Service Bill Reveal What is Corrupt, Comic, Cynical, and Noble About Washington. I asked Waldman to explain how national service was pitched during Clinton's campaign.
Well, the basic idea, it had 2 parts. He said, everyone should be able to go to college and be able to pay back the college loan money 1 of 2 ways, either by doing community service as a teacher or a nurse or a policeman, or by paying back their college loan as a percentage of income over time. That's a student loan reform proposal, basically. And the book follows both of those components as it goes through the legislative process and encounters a wide range of hostile and friendly interest groups that try to smother the ideas.
Now, did Clinton have to scale back national service once he got elected? Scale back his proposal?
Practically within minutes of his election, he had to scale it back. The original scale of the plan talked about during the campaign would be something where anyone who wanted to pay back their college loans this way through community service would be able to. So that could be 500,000 people, 1 million people. They didn't really know, but it was on that order of magnitude. And that would be a program that would cost $8, $9, $10 billion a year. Once they got in and they saw the size of the deficit problem, they had to start scaling everything back. And in fact, they never really even considered proposing a national service plan the size that they talked about during the campaign. It was scaled back very early on to something in the $1 billion range, $2 billion range.
Your book, The Bill, is in part about special interests and what they do to legislation. So let's look at how the special interests went about preserving their own interests in this national service bill. Let's look at the banking industry at first. What was at stake for the banking industry?
Well, in that second half of the promise, which sounds very simple, is just to get a college loan and be able to pay it back as a percentage of income over time. I refer to that plan through the book as pay-as-you-can loans. And Clinton liked the idea because it meant that if you had a lot of loan debt, you wouldn't be deterred from, you know, becoming a Head Start teacher or a nurse or a relatively low-paying profession, that you'd still be able to do that and have affordable payments, because rather than being a fixed payment tied to the amount of the loan, it would be a variable payment tied to whatever you were earning in a given year. The problem with that was that it was too hard to administer under the current loan system, which is a bank-based system. Currently, basically, banks give out the loans, and they get guarantees from the federal government. And it's a very complicated system. It's been this way for a couple of decades. And in order to do this policy reform, Clinton would actually have to scrap the entire student aid system along the way. And that meant that the banks and other financial institutions that had a stake in the existing program and were doing quite nicely off it would lose a lot of money. And in this case, it was kind of a classic interest group drama, interest group that had become comfortable and was doing well off the current government program, was fighting like hell to keep the status quo.
What did they do to fight for what they wanted?
They basically used every lobbying trick in the book to try to preserve things, and that ranged from, in the more conventional sense, they just hired a very impressive roster of Washington influence peddlers and lobbyists, with an emphasis, incidentally, on getting big-name Democrats to lobby the Democratic Congress and the Democratic administration. That was one thing they did, but they also did something which is really much more typical of the way lobbying works now, which is they went to great efforts to organize or orchestrate grassroots, quote-unquote, lobbying efforts. It's really become very common here. It is the dominant form of lobbying, really more important than the backroom sort of slipping something in the bill behind closed doors type of lobbying. And they were very aggressive at that. In particular, what they tried to do is get allies from outside the banking industry. I mean, they knew that they had a limited amount of credibility with the legislators because people just figured, well, they're just out to protect their own interests. So they had to find allies who didn't seem to have a vested interest in it.
And what allies did they find?
The most effective ones were the financial aid officers at local colleges. These are the people on the front line, people who actually do the paperwork, who fill out the loans, who work with the students. And the banks and their allies would send out SWAT teams to local colleges to give briefings to these local financial aid administrators and sort of help scare the dickens out of them. And the financial aid administrators had some legitimate concerns about this. They'd spent the previous 10 years learning how to master this very arcane financial aid system, and here we were going to have scrapped the entire system, have the Department of Education take it over and give out the money directly to the schools. So they were very worried about it, and they weighed in on behalf of the banks and on behalf of preserving the current student loan system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Waldman. He covers Congress for Newsweek and is the author of the book The Bill, How the Adventures of Clinton's National Service Bill Reveal What is Corrupt, Comical, Cynical, and Noble About Washington. Now, what did labor have to say about national service?
The unions feared that if you had service programs getting, having a young person, say, working to clean up parks, that that would displace existing unionized employees who already work for the Parks Department. And the Parks Department would look at them, well, hey, if we can get some young guy to come in and clean up the parks for a third of the price or a third of the wage, well, then we'll just hire them. Why hire people at this higher unionized rate? So the unions pushed very hard for provisions in the bill that would prevent the new program from doing types of service that would displace jobs from existing unionized employees. And they were largely successful in getting that language in the bill very early on when the administration was writing the legislation.
In looking at how special influence changed the shape of Clinton's National Service Bill, would you say that special interest groups, when put together, represent the larger interests of American citizens?
No, which is not to say they don't have good arguments in the particular. And this is really an important point, I think, to understand the way Washington works. Special interest groups are not all greedy people working solely for their own pecuniary gain. Very often, each special interest group has a very legitimate argument on the merits in the particular. And I'll give you one example that I think shows this as well as anything else. They decided to set up a structure for this program that would be very decentralized. Most of the money would be given out not by the federal government, but by independent state commissions appointed by the state governors. And they thought, well, we'll have this be a bipartisan commissions, and each state would have one. And when the White House made its proposal, they suggested that these commissions have between seven and 13 members. Now, they made a couple of extra points. They said, well, to assuage the unions, we'll make sure that we'll guarantee that one of the commissioners has to represent labor. And to mollify some of the local governments that were worried that the governors might take over the commissions, we'll guarantee that a representative will come from local government. And they put a couple of other guarantees like that on. And that was just the White House proposal. Once the interest groups saw that the White House was putting some seats set aside for particular groups, then everyone lined up to demand equal treatment. A group called Young People for National Service, they got a quota for a person between age 16 and 25. Senior citizens groups got a guaranteed slot for an elderly person. Public schools got a guaranteed slot for themselves. And that was just the Senate. And then the House had its own list of people. They said if labor is going to get a slot, then business should also get a slot. And it went on and on like this. And when you added it all up, for this 13-person commission, you already had 14 guaranteed slots. And it became a farce. And this was before you even got to making the commissions bipartisan and diverse with respect to race, ethnicity, age, gender, and disability characteristics. So naturally, the solution that Congress came up with was to enlarge the commissions from 13 to 25 to accommodate all these different interest groups' demands. And this, to me, was a fascinating process because every one of those interest groups had a legitimate argument. The seniors argued that, look, we have this. We shouldn't just be talking about young people. There are millions of seniors who've already volunteered and they have a lot of time to volunteer. They should be a part of this. Well, that was true. And you had young people arguing, well, you know, most of the people in this program are going to be young. We ought to have someone, a young person, in the decision-making process. Well, that was true, too. And in fact, all of them had legitimate arguments. And the problem is that the sum of legitimate narrow interest does not necessarily add up to the public interest. And in this case with the state commissions, you can see it rather clearly when it became a kind of a comic farce. But you could see that in other issues as well.
Stephen Waldman is my guest. He covers Congress for Newsweek, and he's the author of a new book called The Bill. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Waldman. He covers Congress for Newsweek, and he's the author of the new book, The Bill, How the Adventures of Clinton's National Service Bill Reveal What is Corrupt, Comic, Cynical, and Noble About Washington. You know, we haven't even dealt with what happened in Congress yet. You write about what the preparations were like for a congressional debate on Clinton's National Service Bill. And his people were predicting all kinds of amendments banning gays from participating, amendments saying health insurance wouldn't be allowed to use for abortion, there could be random drug testing of participants. How many of these predicted amendments were actually proposed?
Well, it ended up being a different set of equally irksome amendments. I don't think they ended up proposing the gay ban out of national service, but in the case of national service, after it had gone through all these interest group gauntlets, it then hit a Republican filibuster in the Senate. The Republicans, even though there were four Republican co-sponsors of the legislation, and they'd gotten a few other Republican votes. When it came time to pass the legislation on the floor of the Senate, a group of conservative senators realized that they had enough votes to block the legislation. So they began a filibuster. And this is when you started to see some of the greatest amount of chaos in the system. In the Senate, unlike the House, they don't have to tell you what amendments they're going to do ahead of time. They can just stand up and offer an amendment, and that'll be the first you hear of it. So you have to prepare for everything. In fact, one of the amendments that was offered to the National Service Bill was one by Jesse Helms having to do with the Daughters of the Confederacy and whether or not they should have an official government imprimatur. And it had nothing to do with national service, but then again, amendments don't have to have anything to do with the bills they're going on. And that led to a threatened filibuster by Carol Mosley Braun, the senator from Illinois, on top of the filibuster that was already going on national service, a filibuster within a filibuster. So all hell was breaking loose, and it became rather comic at times, and you really had to shake your head in amazement that this is the way laws are made.
So how does the bill that President Clinton proposed compare to the bill that passed after it went through the gauntlet of special interests and congressmen?
Well, for one thing, obviously it's quite a bit smaller in scale. The original campaign promise was talking about 500,000 people, 750,000 people serving. Right now we have about 30,000 people. So it's quite a bit smaller by comparison. On the other hand, it is already, just in its first year, bigger than the Peace Corps was at its peak. So it's still a fairly significant achievement. The scholarship level was supposed to be in the campaign. They had said if you do a year of service, you would get a $10,000 scholarship. And that was designed to be that high because they thought it would be important to help people pay for private college as well as public college, and it needed to be that high to attract middle-class kids. And that eventually got knocked down all the way down to $4,800. So that's another important difference.
Are there any really obvious things that you would change if you were given the power to reform Congress?
There's one thing that I think has gotten overlooked a little bit in talking about the first 100 days of the Republican Congress. Putting aside the substance of what Gingrich and his allies have done, the contract, in a sense, was one of the most effective tools for dealing with interest group dynamics that I've seen so far.
How did it help in dealing with special interest groups?
In this sense, Gingrich was able to say, when interest groups were coming pleading for different favors on the contract, Gingrich was able to say, other members of Congress were able to say, look, I'd love to help you on that. I'll be there, you know, in the second 200 days. But we've got to keep our eye on the contract. We have to pass that. We signed our name on the dotted line here, and voters will punish us if we don't do it. Now, you know, in some cases, what they wanted to do was open the committee table to the interest group lobbyists, and they did that, because ideologically they wanted to. But the idea of having a set out legislative agenda that the public knows about during the congressional elections, that there's some expectation that people will be held to that, is actually an effective way of dealing with interest group pressure.
Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America provided this whole sense of theater about the Congress that I think it's lacked in the recent past. So has that made your job more interesting?
They certainly were quite good at orchestrating this and quite good at keeping discipline. You know, it's really, in a way, it's become more like covering the White House, where The White House always, or at least since President Reagan mastered the technique, all issues were very carefully orchestrated, messages were carefully orchestrated, and the job of the White House reporter was always to find out what was going on behind the scenes. What were the ideological struggles? What were the real reasons that things ended up in particular ways? Congress was usually more of an open book. Now, because Gingrich has imposed more discipline on his own party and kept to a more rigorous schedule, you have to do more behind-the-scenes reporting about how things are actually working. How did this get in the contract? How did it end up that this provision stayed in and that provision didn't? Because usually you could look at the committee markups and hearings and you could figure that out. Now a lot of those decisions are being made behind closed doors among the congressional leadership. So it becomes a little bit more, in some ways it's a harder, it's easier in the sense there's more drama. He has big climactic votes, and that makes it easier to create a sense of drama, but it's harder in the sense that a lot of the real decision-making is happening behind closed doors.
Do you have a sense of what Republican congressmen actually feel about Newt Gingrich now, whether he's a popular leader, whether he's resented because of the discipline that he's trying to maintain over the members of the House?
I think initially he was resented for that, particularly, you know, the ones who directly felt it, who, you know, didn't have as much flexibility in what they were going to do on their committees and that kind of thing. But right now, there is a sense of awe. There really is, even among the members of Congress. It's awe combined with a sense of anxiety that sometimes he seems about to lose it, Gingrich does, and seems to go too far out in his rhetoric. But basically, they're quite impressed, and I think he has built up a lot of capital with his own members because he can now say, look, I know I jammed this in your face. I know I told you you couldn't do this or you couldn't do that, but look what we got accomplished. So, you know, bear with me, and we'll, you know, in a way, the best sign for Gingrich is that both the moderates and the conservatives, when you talk to them privately, think Gingrich is their guy. Watching out for their interests in the private counsels. I think that there's enough personal suspicion of Gingrich and his ego. Everyone there recognizes the guy has a huge ego. There's enough personal suspicion that I think if they start having some legislative losses, that his popularity among the members will plummet rapidly. But for now, they really do have the sense of nothing succeeds like success, and you got to hand it to them. And they came from the minority party for 40 years, and with Gingrich's leadership, pulled off really more than they imagined they could in the first 100 days.
Stephen Waldman, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure. I appreciate it.
Stephen Waldman is congressional correspondent for Newsweek and author of the new book, The Bill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Former Congressman Timothy Penny says he's learned that Congress spends too much time looking out for itself and too little time focusing on America's distant horizons. That's why he left the institution after 12 years and is now trying to change the way Congress does business. Coming up, we talk with Penny about the culture of Congress. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two new releases by saxophonist James Carter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Pentagon has finished its review of how the United Nations protected classified documents in Somalia. American officials report that in the last days of the UN pullout from Somalia, they found several boxes of secret American files in a UN compound. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Pentagon analysts conclude no damage was done to U.S. intelligence sources, and current policies within both the U.S. military and the UN adequately protect classified information. But in a memo, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Shalikashvili wrote, both American and U.N. personnel failed to follow those policies. Some files the Americans handed over to the U.N. were labeled with the wrong security classification, and in one instance, Americans handed over one page of one document when that page should have been deleted. The review also found UN staff failed to protect the files. Pentagon officials say the U.S. should continue to share intelligence material with the UN during peacekeeping missions. They recommend better training and security procedures backed up with spot inspections. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
President Clinton and Defense Secretary William Perry are praising the eight men who died last night in the crash of an Air Force jet in Alabama. One of the four Assistant Air Force Secretaries, Clark Feaster, is among the dead. So is Air Force Major General Glenn Proffitt. He was the Director of Plans and Operations at the Air Education Training Command. The Air Force has appointed an investigation board to discover the cause of the accident. U.S. and Japanese negotiators are continuing their Washington talks to find agreement on opening the Japanese market to more auto imports. NPR's John Itzde reports.
There are few signs of progress and little hope of immediate breakthrough in the long-running talks aimed at getting more U.S. autos and auto parts into the Japanese market. Less than 5% of the cars sold in Japan are imports, while Japanese exports alone account for about 15% of the cars sold in the U.S. Autos and auto parts accounted for 60% of last year's record U.S. trade deficit with Japan. U.S. officials have suggested they'll impose stiff sanctions on Japan if it fails to open its market wider, but they say they still hope the negotiations will produce an agreement. The U.S. wants Japan to change its inspection and repair requirements, which go beyond safety, according to U.S. officials, and discriminate against U.S. products. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
The Houston Post has published its last edition. The Post's parent company, Consolidated Newspapers, says the Post has sold some of its assets to Hearst Corporation, which runs the rival Houston Chronicle. The transaction ends 94 years of competition between the papers. It also makes Houston the largest city in the nation to have only one daily paper. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow fell 16.25 points to end the day at 4,179. This is NPR. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have reportedly rejected an appeal by Libya to let flights with Muslim pilgrims aboard pass through their airspace en route to Mecca. NPR Suni Khalid reports.
A three-year United Nations travel ban against Libya remained in effect today, despite efforts to fly thousands of Libyan pilgrims to the upcoming Hajj religious pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia. This week, the Egyptian and Saudi governments considered a request from Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to send two plane loads of pilgrims to Saudi Arabia, but both governments said they will wait until the United Nations decides whether to grant a waiver. The UN banned air travel to and from Libya in 1992 as part of its economic sanctions against the Gaddafi regime. The sanctions were imposed because of Libya's refusal to turn over two suspects wanted for their alleged involvement in the 1988 downing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have been looking for a way to allow Libyan pilgrims to travel to the Hajj without breaking the UN sanctions or angering the Muslim community. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
A consumer group is criticizing commercialism in American classrooms. Consumers Union says there's too much of it, from advertising on school buses to sponsored contests to video programs that contain ads. Leaders of the study say the trend puts the integrity of education at risk. It also says its study looked at more than 100 samples of sponsored educational materials, and nearly 70% had biased information that promoted the companies that paid for the material or ignored their competition. The Supreme Court says people who claim problems from certain childhood vaccinations must be able to prove their cases. The court has ruled those seeking federal damages must show they were not sick before they got the shots. The Justice Department says the decision could affect hundreds of claims averaging $1 million apiece. The ruling stems from an Indiana couple's case. They claimed their child suffered physical and mental disabilities because of a shot she received when she was 4 months old. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Timothy Penny says he was young, idealistic, and naive when he was sworn into the House of Representatives on January 1, 1983. He was 31 years old, a Democrat, representing a rural part of Minnesota. He started off a true believer in the political system, but he grew increasingly dissatisfied with how Congress works. After 6 terms, he decided not to run for re-election. He explains why in his new memoir, Common Sense, which is co-authored with journalist Major Garrett. When Penny was in Congress, his priority was reducing the deficit. He says he learned a lot about what's wrong with the culture of Congress when he co-sponsored a bipartisan bill with Republican John Kasich, which proposed spending cuts of $90 billion. Penny told me a lot of his Democratic colleagues were less than enthusiastic about this bipartisan effort.
That's sacrilege on Capitol Hill to work with Republicans on almost any issue. But clearly when it comes to deficit spending, there's no way to get rid of the red ink without bipartisan cooperation. Both parties need to put their sacred cows on the table, and it needs to be a shared sacrifice.
Well, you write that you think you alienated, well, that you know you alienated leaders of your own party because of this bipartisan spending cut bill. What price do you think you paid?
Well, it wasn't the first time that I had reached across the aisle to work with Republicans on issues. I had made attempts at spending reduction efforts in the past in which I tried to build bipartisan support. I suppose the price may be that I wasn't placed on the Ways and Means Committee, which is the most powerful committee on Capitol Hill. It controls most entitlement spending, Social Security, Medicare. It obviously deals with the tax code, deals with trade issues. If you really want to be a key player, that's probably the committee to serve on.
You write about what you call the culture of fear in Congress, and you say there's a lot of pressure to react to the whims of an electorate that sends mixed signals and grows enraged when lawmakers fail to satisfy its irreconcilable demands. What's an example of irreconcilable demands that you felt you were getting?
Well, obviously, the Republican contract with America makes conflicting promises. On the one hand, and bear in mind that this contract with America was constructed not as a governing document, but as a campaign document. They basically picked 10 broad issues on which at least two-thirds of the electorate responded favorably, in which at least two-thirds of the poll respondents responded favorably. And among those were strong support for a balanced budget amendment, as well as strong support for a middle-class tax cut. And yet a middle-class tax cut works against the objective of a balanced budget. And so that's an example of where the electorate is sending mixed signals, because by voting for a middle-class tax cut, Republican legislators have put themselves in a position where it's going to be far more difficult for them to actually produce a balanced budget.
Can you think of an example where you felt you were getting mixed messages from your constituency?
Well, all the time. I had a strong pressure from farm constituencies in my district to balance the federal budget, but of course most of them felt that farm programs had already paid more than their fair share toward deficit reduction, and that I should speak out loud and clear for virtue of spending on farm subsidies. In fact, when we had flooding in the Midwest, I took some flack because I suggested that we ought to cut other spending in order to make room in the budget for emergency funding for this flood relief. Some of my constituents felt that was carrying things a bit too far. They didn't mind an honest budget. They didn't mind efforts to keep the budget in the black. But when it came to the flooding in our own district, they didn't care whether we borrowed that money just so they got the disaster relief.
Congress is often criticized for being unresponsive. You write that the problem is that it's too responsive. It's too often controlled by polling. Did you use polls while you were in office?
Not since 1985, so it's been a long time since I ran a poll. And basically, I discovered what intuitively most people would know, and that's that a poll isn't going to tell you anything that you don't know already. If you're in a coffee shop once a week, if you're at a League of Women Voters gathering, or at any other setting, I mean, you're going to get feedback from folks that will tell you pretty much what a poll would tell you. The other thing is, polls only tell you what people think at the moment, and they aren't necessarily based on an in-depth knowledge of the issues. And so polls reflect feelings more than attitudes or judgments. And frankly, in our representative democracy, we are elected to sort out all the facts and to apply our judgment to the issues, not simply to put our fingers in the wind and follow the latest opinion polls.
Timothy Penny is my guest. He was a Democratic congressman from Minnesota from 83 to 94. And he's written a memoir about his years in Congress. It's also a critique of Congress. It's called Common Sense. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with former Democratic congressman from Minnesota, Timothy Penny. He's written a new memoir called Common Sense. In describing what you call the culture of fear, you, of course, write a lot about lobbies. Maybe you could give us an example of something, of a bill where you were either promised something or threatened with something if you didn't vote a certain way.
Well, the most vivid memory I have of interest group pressure was in 1984 when I was seeking re-election to Congress, after serving less than a full term in Congress, I was obviously considered to be one of those vulnerable newcomers, it was likely that the Republican Party was going to spend enormous sums of money to get rid of me and a lot of other freshman Democrats. That meant that I had to rely, as Democrats generally do, on the support of organized labor for my reelection campaign. I was summoned to the AFL-CIO headquarters, where I was chastised for a less than sterling voting record on labor issues. I believe my record that year was 70%. But I was told that other Minnesota Democrats were closer to 90 or 100%, and that they expected the same allegiance from me. I admit that I didn't take too kindly to their suggestion that I vote more faithfully with the AFL-CIO. I think I lectured them a bit on deficit reduction, since that was an issue on which we disagreed, and I clearly left them with the impression that while I may have voted with them 70%, that it was only because I gave them a few votes that I wish I had not. It sort of frosted our relationship for the remainder of my term in office. But the point is that most confrontations with interest groups are not that direct. I mean, that was a rare experience in Washington. Typically, the confrontation is within your own mind. It's sort of you're wrestling with your own conscience. If you rely too heavily on special interest money, it can compromise you, and sometimes it compromises you in ways that you're not even aware of yourself. Almost every vote that comes up on the House floor can create sort of a challenge between what you know to be right and what you know to be politically expedient. And I think that's the compromising aspect of special interest group pressure that's hard to quantify, but it's still very real.
In writing about Congress, you write about what you describe as the culture of power. I think to illustrate this point, I will ask you to tell us about the most expensive 30 seconds of your career.
Oh, yeah. Well, that had to do with an amendment which would have cut $500 million out of the Housing and Urban Development Spending Bill. And the amendment was being offered because the bill was $500 million over budget. In other words, $500 million higher than the amount we agreed we would spend on those programs during that year. As is so often the case on Capitol Hill, you're stretched or you're spread very thin. I had a committee conflict that occurred at the time that amendment was supposed to have been offered on the House floor. There were 3-4 amendments stacked ahead of my amendment, so it appeared that I could make an appearance at the committee, come back to the House floor, and still offer that amendment. But just to be sure, I cleared it with the author of the bill, and was given assurances that it would be at least an hour before they would be taking up my amendment. I left the House floor for no more than 20-25 minutes, and in my absence discovered that the chairman expedited procedures, took several amendments with a voice vote rather than a recorded vote, and as a consequence, as I rushed back to the House floor, I discovered that they had pulled the rug out from under me and that my opportunity to offer the amendment had been done in by a chairman who basically gave me assurances that I could offer the amendment and then did everything in his power to see to it that the amendment would not come up.
You think that, in talking about the culture of power, you think that committee chairs should have term limits, that's even more important than congressional term limits.
Well, I think that's where the the process bogs down. Committee chairmen sort of measure their power by the jurisdiction of their committee, and so there's no incentive for them to reform the programs under their jurisdiction or certainly to get rid of any of the programs under their jurisdiction. In fact, there's every incentive for them to expand the jurisdiction of their committee, which means legislating more, creating more programs. And I really think that you can what you build into the system is a very narrow focus, where each chairman is worried more about their own committee's turf than they are about the larger picture. And so by rotating committee chairmanships, I think you break up that power structure. You undercut the degree to which leaders in the institution are simply trying to protect the status quo, and I think more so than term limiting the entire Congress, term limits on chairmen would serve to inject some dynamism into the process and to challenge the status quo in ways that are not possible as long as you're bucking up against these enormously powerful leaders.
One of the frustrating things about watching Congress work is the scratch my back, I'll scratch yours approach to passing legislation. I'll vote for your bill if you vote for my amendment. Did you ever fall prey to that yourself? Did you ever find yourself voting for something you really didn't believe in, but you needed to do it to get a vote for a bill you were proposing?
Well, let me give you a small example. The honey program is a program that the country could have lived without a long time ago. There's actually a subsidy for honey producers in the federal budget. And the argument was that, well, I don't know what the argument was, but it got in there. There was a subsidy for mohair, a subsidy for rice, a subsidy for cotton and sugar and wheat and corn. Why not a subsidy for honey? Because I was on the Agriculture Committee, the logic went something like this. No one else in the committee is going to vote to get rid of the honey program. If I do this, I really stand out like a sore thumb. It's not a very big program. Agricultural programs have already taken, sizable budget cuts. Why should we offer up another budget cut when the larger budget problem really lies with other committees and their programs? So, I mean, you make all these rationalizations as to why you're not going to vote to kill the honey program, but I should have voted to kill it long ago. I finally cast the vote to kill it in my last session of Congress. not so much to honor President Clinton, who listed that program as the only program he was willing to get rid of, but to honor Silvio Conti, a deceased member of Congress from Massachusetts, who for many years led the fight to get rid of the honey program. And I guess it was out of guilt. I always felt I should have voted with him, and so I finally gave Silvio a vote.
So but what did you get for voting?
Nothing.
To keep it in the past?
Absolutely nothing, except goodwill on the part of my colleagues on the committee, sense that I was a team player, sense that I was, you know, a real advocate for agriculture. But what did I get in return? You know, I suppose the goodwill, you know, bought me some influence on the committee. But, you know, here again, you have to wonder whether whether the trade-off was worth it.
Would you ever want to get into elected office again?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Major Garrett and I got together to write this book because we felt that a retired legislator and a journalist could put together stories on Capitol Hill that would help to inform the electorate, because in the final analysis, the voters are in charge. But we feel that people are mystified by politics and politicians, and we wanted to demystify the process. I've decided that rather than running for political office, there's a lot that you can do on the outside to influence the political debate, and I think this book is one attempt.
Well, Tim Penny, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you. I enjoyed visiting with you today.
Former Congressman Timothy Penny, his new book about Congress, Common Sense, is co-authored with journalist Major Garrett. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, today we'll have the first part of a series of reports by John McChesney on Microsoft. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the retirement of Joe Montana, a professional quarterback extraordinaire. And we'll also be hearing today from George Saunders, a young writer who currently has a novella in the April issue of Harper's Magazine and has a collection of short stories coming out at the end of the year. He talks about his career as a writer and the writer's resume he once tried to compile.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says saxophonist James Carter is the jazz star of the moment, with 3 CDs in the last 6 months on 2 major labels. He's been championed by 2 trumpeters who agree about little else, conservative Wynton Marsalis and liberal Lester Bowie. Here's James Carter on baritone sax from his latest recording, The Real Quiet Storm.
James Carter is a jack of all saxophones, from soprano to bass sax, and a master of at least 2, tenor and baritone. He has lots of youthful male energy and projects a big sound on those larger horns. Carter has the swaggering rhythm of a swing-era saxophonist and a command of freak effects, shrieks and pops and smears that were popular with vaudeville musicians, honking and screaming R&B saxophonists, and free jazz horn players. Putting together all those things from the 20s through the 70s is the 90s touch. James Carter likes obscure old tunes, and he'll quote a Billy Strayhorn ballad and the theme from Sanford and Son in the space of a few seconds. His penchant for odd connections is why he was hired young by broad-minded bandleaders, Lester Bowie and the late Julius Hemphill. Carter has chops, soul, and a competitor's urge to show him off. Here he is on tenor. From JC on the Set, the first and best of James Carter's three current albums. His second, Jurassic Classic, is a little less interesting. He plays tenor, alto, and soprano, but no baritone sax. His latest album, The Real Quiet Storm, is all ballads. Carter still reveals the deep roots of his big sound, but he wants to show he's not just a high-energy hot dog. Trouble is, that is his strength. Maybe it's a sign of the times that each Carter album is less magnetic than the last. In jazz nowadays, there's a tendency to declare a new saxophone king every 12 or 18 months. That hype sells records and magazine ads, but it often stalls a musician's development when it's just getting started. Look at last year's hero, Joshua Redman. If James Carter doesn't spread himself too thin and he keeps his sizable ego in check, he should go the distance. If not, some other saxophonist will show up to replace him, and some record company and some magazines will be there to hand him the crown.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed The Real Quiet Storm and JC on the Set by saxophonist James Carter. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.